Today's episode of Stuff You Missed in History Class is brought to you by Blue Apron. Blue Apron is the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. Check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/history. You will love how it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait. That's blueapron.com/history. One more time, blueapron.com/history. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Netflix streams TV shows and movies directly to your home, saving you time, money, and hassle. As a Netflix member, you can instantly watch TV episodes and movies streaming directly to your PC, Mac, or right to your TV with your Xbox 360, PS3, or Nintendo Wii console, plus Apple devices, Kindle, and Nook. Get a free 30-day trial membership. Go to www.netflix.com and sign up now.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I am Tracy B. Wilson.
And I'm Holly Fry.
And today we have a listener request.
Hooray!
We have many. Who was the real blah de blah.
Yeah.
So we have who was the real Moriarty, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And one of our oft-requested things, in this case by Michael and many other listeners, is who was the real Robin Hood?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is a tricky question in point of fact.
It kind of is. Robin Hood-style characters have been showing up in literature since the 14th century, but as a concept, he's kind of been around longer than that, at least 700 years. But his earliest appearance in literature was in English ballads that were singing the tales of a Sherwood Forest criminal who squared off against the Sheriff of Nottingham. Maid Marian and Friar Tuck came on later, but Sherwood Forest and the Sheriff and Little John and Will Scarlet are all there pretty early on, along with the idea of robbing rich people, but not necessarily giving that up to the poor. That comes along later, too.
Historians who actually lived during the medieval period seem to have assumed that Robin Hood was actually a real person who lived in the 12th or 13th century, but their accounts aren't consistent at all, and modern historians aren't so sure about any of that. There's just not evidence to support it necessarily. There's a lot of question marks. And some of the grander elements of the Robin Hood lore are also pretty tricky when you get into the logic of them. 70 merry men may have been able to feed and clothe themselves just working with the spoils of their robbing, but surviving the winter and staying warm without shelter would have been a little bit trickier.
Yeah, it's not a very warm part of the world.
No.
Without some kind of permanent structure to take some kind of refuge from the climate in, which then would have been easily raided. So, that brings us to the question of, is Robin Hood a fictional blend of outlaw, derring do, and some wish fulfillment? Because lots of people like to see other people get their comeuppance.
Oh, yeah.
Or was he a real person, or a combination of both? That's a great question.
That might not be 100% answered ever.
Nope.
But we're going to examine all of the various possibilities.
Yeah. So, in the Middle Ages, places like Sherwood Forest weren't just vast landscapes of tree cover, like we might think of the word forest today. They were kind of a hodgepodge of wooded areas and cultivated ground, so the nobility could use them to hunt and to grow food. And there were also laws about how everyone else was allowed to use the forest.
But the places that were best for game hunting were also great for hiding. So places like Sherwood Forest were perfect for outlaws to call home. It was a great place to hide out. And it was extra great because it was illegal for them to even be doing that. So it was a perfect setting for these Robin Hood-style adventure stories that have persisted throughout the ages.
The earliest known written reference to Robin Hood is a passing reference in William Langland's allegorical poem, The Vision of Piers Plowman, which was written in the late 1370s. He says, "I don't know perfectly my Our Father as the priest sings it. I know rhymes of Robin Hood and Randolph Earl of Chester, but neither of Our Lord nor of Our Lady, the least that ever was written." So he's basically saying, I don't really know my prayers, but I do know Robin Hood.
And after that, there's a series of ballads and stories that came along throughout the 14th and 15th centuries. Great hits like Robin Hood and the Monk.
The Little Jest of Robin Hood.
Robin Hood, His Death.
Robin Hood and Guy of Gisborne.
And Robin Hood and the Curtle Friar.
So there's not so much of a really noble rob from the rich, give to the poor focus in a lot of these older stories. There is definitely a lot of robbing, not necessarily a lot of giving. In some of the early stories, Robin's just really violent. And he's not a fallen noble in these stories, which is an idea that was attributed to him later. He's a commoner, a peasant, or at the highest, a yeoman, which was kind of a middle class situation. The king mentioned in these early works is Edward, probably meaning Edward II, while a lot of the more modern portrayals talk about a Prince John or a King John.
And Little John and Will Scarlet are also early names that show up in the context of being Robin's merry men. But as we said before, there was no Maid Marian in these early ballads or Friar Tuck. Those really got added in later.
In the context of literature, Robin Hood got upgraded to a nobleman in 1601 in Anthony Munday's plays The Downfall of Robert, Earl of Huntingdon, and The Death of Robert, Earl of Huntingdon.
Around 1770, Robin Hood's Garland, being a complete history of all the notable and merry exploits performed by him and his men on diverse occasions, to which is added a preface giving a more full and particular account of his birth, etc., than any hitherto published, came out. That's quite a title.
I love those extremely long titles.
And this particular piece of literature added more stories and more characters to the Robin Hood lore. So there was lots of Robin Hood meeting somebody in the woods, fighting with that person, and then eventually inviting him to join him and the merry men in their exploits.
By the 19th century, Robin Hood stories were everywhere. Howard Pyle's The Merry Adventures of Robin Hood of Great Renown in Nottinghamshire came out in 1883. This gathered lots of Robin Hood stuff into one place and also adapted it for children. And it became a source material for a lot of the later Robin Hood writing. This was an illustrated book. It was really expensive for its time compared to other books, and it was wildly successful.
And following that, there were plays, operas, comic books, films, and more films.
So many Robin Hood movies.
Costumes, merchandise. Robin Hood was like a marketing juggernaut.
Yeah, he's become kind of just an iconic figure, especially in the world of English stories.
Yeah.
So, is there any truth to all of this? One of the earliest historical notations of Robin Hood was from John Major, a Scottish historian, who wrote his History of Greater Britain in 1521. He claims Robin Hood did his criminal living in Sherwood Forest in 1193 and 1194. Should I read what he says about it?
Yes, give us a little passage.
Okay, he says, "About this time it was, as I conceive, that there flourished those famous robbers, Robert Hood, an Englishman, and Little John, who lay wait in the woods, but spoiled of their goods those only that were wealthy. They took the life of no man, unless either he attacked them or offered resistance in defense of his property. Robert supported by his plundering 100 bowmen, ready fighters every one, with whom 400 of the strongest would not dare to engage in combat. The feats of this Robert are told in sons all over Britain. He would allow no woman to suffer injustice, nor would he spoil the poor, but rather enrich them from the plunder taken from abbots. The robberies of this man I condemn, but of all robbers he was the humanest and the chief." So he's pretty much solidly in favor of Robin Hood. Not cool for stealing, but definitely cool for all that other stuff.
Yeah. And other historians of the time, including Andrew of Wintoun and Walter Bower, concurred that Robin Hood was active during the middle and late 1200s.
So they all sort of have this consensus about him being a real person, although their dates are different.
Yeah.
Much of today's historical writing is not quite so sure that he was a real person. And most of that research has involved sifting through old court records, which is what we will talk about next.
But the court records, even though they're legal documents, don't entirely support the literary and historical writings. So I'm sure some people are not so enthused about them.
No.
Because some people want to believe, they want to find a true Robin Hood in the mix.
Yeah. So the name Robert Hod appears in court documents in 1225. And this is the earliest known record of a criminal's name that may have morphed its way into Robin Hood.
There is another man that appears in the court records from 1261 and 1262. And in the 1261 document, he's named William, son of Robert Lefevre. And in 1262, he's William Robehod, suggesting that the court transcriber knew of the Robin Hood legend and possibly ascribed his name to an outlaw.
From there are other Robehods and Robin Hoods in legal records, including people who deliberately took Robehod or Robin Hood as their last names in the 13th and 14th centuries, and people who adopted Little John as pseudonyms. And so it's basically people who heard this famous name and decided that should be their name too, because they were outlaws.
Yeah. And all of these Robehods and Robin Hoods muddy the waters when you're actually trying to look for a real source of the stories. It certainly makes it seem like Robin Hood was enough of a legend by the 13th century that people wanted to adopt his name as theirs.
There are also a couple of other examples of Robin Hood who were definitely criminals, but there's some reason that historians say he was not the right guy. He either lived too far away, or he was just a straight-up murderer and you know, didn't do the kind of thieving that Robin Hood was known for.
And apart from that, in 1852, Joseph Hunter published a book citing a Robin Hood who worked as a porter in the king's court in 1324. And he connected this to a journey the king is described as taking in the ballad A Jest of Robin Hood. Hunter speculates that this is the same person as a Robin Hood who was outlawed in 1322, but there's no proof that these are actually the same person. And without the connection, it doesn't really seem to add up or hold up.
Then we get into the suspects whose names do not sound like the words Robin and Hood. Roger Godbird was a 13th century farmer turned baron turned criminal who ambushed rich travelers with his band of men. The Sheriff of Nottingham captured him and held him in Nottingham Castle, and his criminal dealings went on from around 1267 to 1272.
A couple of writers have published books claiming that Roger Goldbird was the real Robin Hood, including David Baldwin and Brian Benson. Baldwin also claims that he discovered a 13th century grave belonging to Godbird. Baldwin's book is Robin Hood, the English Outlaw Unmasked, and Benson's book is titled Robin Hood, the Real Story.
But Robehod and other pseudonyms, meaning Robin Hood, were already in use before Goldbird appeared in the historical record.
So, writing for History Today, Sean McGlynn actually cites William of Kensham, a.k.a. Willikin of the Weald, and he was loyal to the crown and led a resistance band of about 1,000 archers against French invaders in 1216. His resistance was quite successful, and as a reward, he was granted wardenship of the 700s of the Weald, a division of land, with Weald being a heavily wooded place. McGlynn argues that he has the right blend of hero and outlaw qualities because the English would have viewed him as a hero while the French would have viewed him as an outlaw.
And there are also some other real outlaws who aren't that often cited as a real Robin Hood, but whose activities may have influenced some of the stories of Robin Hood shenanigans that came along later. Really, you don't really have to look far during that period of history to find people who were fighting in the woods using bows and arrows.
Yeah.
Right. That was a pretty common thing. So one is Fulk Fitzwarren, who spent some time living in the forest and fighting against King John. Another is Hereward the Wake, an outlaw who fought the Normans not long after the Battle of Hastings. And a third is Eustace the Monk, who I think I might want to do an episode on later on, because Eustace the Monk just sounds like a delightful thing to talk about.
Indeed.
He's not really delightful, though. He became a mercenary after leaving the monastic life to avenge his murdered father. Even William Wallace fits this very general description of guy who was an outlaw and fought from the woods.
Yeah. And Robin Hood changes and evolves with the times. So in his earliest incarnations, he was tied to the violence that was common in the Middle Ages. But then in a trend that is probably quite familiar to modern audiences, public sentiment was beginning to see royalty and wealthy people in general as a bunch of tyrants who were abusing the law and making life harder for the commoner. So that, you know, mindset was ripe for criminals who would try to take these people down a notch, and stories that would celebrate that kind of activity. And nowadays, Robin Hood is a challenger of authority, and he rights wrongs. And the people who do these kinds of things are celebrated as Robin Hood figures.
So, yeah,
we don't. Sometimes they're animated as cute little foxes.
I know. I was going to ask you if you had a favorite Robin Hood, and I thought that that might be the one that you would say.
It's high on the list, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But I don't. I have a detested Robin Hood.
Oh, no. Who is it?
It's the Kevin Costner version.
Oh, yeah.
It's one of the movies I had to leave. I couldn't make it through the whole thing.
Yeah. I think there are people, this is not about that comment. There are people who get really angry about portrayals of Robin Hood that they're like, that's not how it was. When how it was...
We don't know.
The earliest depictions, a lot of the things that we just sort of assume have always been the case about Robin Hood weren't really so much there. Like, the giving to the poor part,
yeah,
not always present. A lot of times it was just robbing.
I just thought it was a poorly made movie.
That
it could have been about anything.
Pretty valid.
But I do really like the Disney version, even though, of course, it's completely manipulated to be really cutesy, and history kind of gets tossed out the window a bit, mostly because foxes don't wear clothes.
No. They typically do not do that. I like Robin Hood.
I do too. It's such a fun story, and I like that it is something that evolves and kind of becomes what any part of history and culture needs it to be.
Yeah. And I would kind of rather we never know if there was a definite number one real person who was, quote, the real Robin Hood. I like him to be kind of mythic and legendary.
Well, unless somebody discovers a magical historical artifact, you get your wish.
Okay. Let's not ever do that.
Hey, Tracy.
Uh-huh?
Do you wish to pause for a brief moment and discuss stamps.com?
Yes, I do.
So, I know that you are hyper-efficient.
I try to be.
And I always want to be, but often fall short. But one of the ways that you can easily streamline your day, particularly if you're running a small business, is to just get rid of those trips to the post office that tend to suck up a lot of time.
Yep.
And it's stuff you have to do. You got to ship stuff out. But if you could do it faster, life would be so much better. So fortunately, Stamps.com has got you covered. Everything you could do at the post office, you can also do right from your desk if you have Stamps.com. It's really quick and easy to use, and you can buy and print official U.S. postage just right there at your desk with your own computer and printer. Stamps.com will actually send you a digital scale that plugs into your computer, and it can instantly calculate your exact postage for any letter or package, so there's absolutely no guesswork. And they will help you decide the best class of mail that you should use based on your needs. So it's vaguely akin to having your own personal postal expert right there with you every step of the way, which is a fabulous and delightful benefit. Right now, you can get a special offer using our promo code, which is STUFF, and that entitles you to a no-risk trial plus a $110 bonus offer, which includes the digital scale and up to $55 of free postage. So don't wait. Go to stamps.com, but before you do anything else, be sure to click on the microphone at the top of the homepage and type in STUFF. That's stamps.com, and enter STUFF. Hey, do you also have some listener mail for us?
I do. This is from Kira, and it is about our recent episode on cannibalism at Jamestown. And I was delighted to read it because it has awesome information in it.
Yeah.
So Kira says, I'm writing to you in regards to the Cannibalism at Jamestown podcast, knowing a little bit about the topic myself. I just graduated with my bachelor's in history this past month, and my senior thesis was on the trade interactions between the Jamestown colonists and the Powhatans. It was a long, laborious, and difficult topic since there isn't a whole lot of primary sources to go off of, as you well know by now. That being said, my topic originally included elements of cannibalism at Jamestown, although I was asked to remove that portion because there wasn't enough evidence to fully support my use of it. It took me a couple of weeks to listen to this podcast because, frankly, I was a little tired of the topic and needed a break, but mostly because I was a teensy bit frustrated that after I had researched the topic of cannibalism so extensively, then was asked to remove it, then more evidence surfaced in the news 2 days after I turned in my final draft.
That's just cruel.
I know, and one of the first things that I said in my response was, I really empathize with you, Kira, because that happens to us at work
yeah.
on a pretty regular basis. So, There were two little points in the podcast that I wanted to correct you on, however. The first was the use of the term Algonquin toward the beginning of the podcast. It was used as though the Algonquins were a specific tribe, when in fact it is an umbrella term for all of the Native Americans in the area. It would be similar to referring to Eskimos as the name of a tribe when they're actually a broader group of people than that. You were correct in your usage of Powhatans as being an encompassing term for all of the tribes that Chief Powhatan, which was his nickname, incidentally. His real name was Wahun Senakawa. I hope I said that correctly. So he was, Powhatan was a term for all the tribes that he reigned over. Thank you for sending that, because one of my biggest frustrations in working on this podcast was how loose and inaccurate all of the writing, not all, but much of the writing from sources who ought to have known better, was about the various Native Americans who were in the area.
Well, and it's inconsistent, so you can't, like, compare two sources to validate each other.
Right.
Without getting into a really deep conundrum pretty quickly.
Yeah, and Kira said that it also took her some time to figure that out when she was working on her thesis. So, yeah, a lot of the writing about the Native Americans in the area at the time, some of it just straight up says the Indians, as though that is accurate. And
I bet those writers were having the same problem.
Probably so.
Like, how can I word this where it's technically correct, but maybe not accurate?
Right. And then there's a lot of things that are used interchangeably that are not actually interchangeable. So thank you for providing that clarification, Kira. So now on to the second part. The second and more important point was when you mentioned that during that awful winter of 1608 and 09, the colonists had run out of copper and blue beads, and stated this as being the reason why they could not secure adequate trade deals with the Powhatans. This actually could not be any farther from being correct. The emphasis of my thesis dealt with the starving time in particular, and this was one of the more difficult portions to fine-tune, so I understand where someone could go wrong with the presented information. What actually happened was that the English, as well as the French and Dutch colonists throughout North America, had oversaturated the Native American market with copper and blue beads. The market was so overly saturated that the items no longer held monetary value that the English had planned on. So they still retained their spiritual significance, but because they were so easy to come by, the Powhatans were quite the competent businessmen, and the English were in desperate straits. The English actually had a large supply of beads and copper on hand, but their value had decreased so much that they were trading large bags full of blue beads for a few bushels of corn, when in the past they had been able to get the same amount of corn for only a handful of beads. This problem actually led to John Smith threatening to shoot Chief Powhatan's brother, Opechancanough. It is speculated that Opechancanough never forgave him for this and held a perpetual grudge against the colonists until the massacre of 1622. Or at least that is what I concluded in my thesis. She talked about authors Karen Kupperman, Helen Roundtree, and Carl Breidenbaugh do a fantastic job of illustrating these issues in their various books about Jamestown. Thank you so much for providing this also.
Yeah, it's so cool to have a Jamestown scholar.
Yeah, and that was straight up my error. The sources that I had used kind of glossed over the why part of why they had gone from trading copper and beads and instead were trading extremely valuable items that they could not really bear to part with, mm-hmm. like swords that are needed for survival. And that was sort of my incorrectly filling in that blank because it had been sort of not really acknowledged in my sources. So thank you so much, Kira, for writing to us. This is awesome information. I love owning mistakes when we make genuine mistakes because that makes us have better knowledge.
Yeah.
If you would like to write to us about this or any other topic, you can at historypodcast@discovery.com. We're also on Twitter at MistInHistory and on Facebook at facebook.com/historyclassstuff. You can find our Tumblr at mistinhistory.tumblr.com, and we are on Pinterest too. If you would like to learn more about Robin Hood, you can come to our website and you can search for the word Robin Hood and you will find who was the real Robin Hood. You can do this and a whole lot more at our site, which is howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
On Audible.com is the leading provider of downloadable digital audiobooks and spoken word entertainment. Audible has more than 100,000 titles to choose from to be downloaded to your iPod or MP3 player. Go to audiblepodcast.com/history to get a free audiobook download of your choice when you sign up today.
Hey, I'm Chuck.
And I'm Josh.
And we're the host of Stuff You Should Know, the podcast.
That's right. And if you're into understanding cool and unusual and seemingly ordinary and even boring things that are made interesting, you should check us out.
Please and thank you.
We're on iTunes, Spotify, Google Play Music, anywhere you get podcasts.